Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White, and I'm joined as ever by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. Hi, Tim.
So today we're going to do another one of our quickfire Q&A episode with some questions from you guys. Thanks, as always, for sending those in. We really enjoy hearing what you're thinking about and giving us lots of interesting stuff to discuss. So as always, you can email us by emailing molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. Or if you're a social media person, you can tweet me or X me, whatever it's called these days, at T.S. Wyatt, W-Y-A-T-T. Our first question today, Dad, comes from someone called Stephen, and he's responding to our recent episode about evolution. And he says, while I would agree with you both on favouring a guided creation, I'm currently studying at a world-class science university, shall we say, and in the Christian Union there have many friends who do actually believe in the literal 6 days creation present in Genesis. They are obviously people who striving to work and embrace and continue scientific theory, but they defend their position by saying that God is powerful enough to have created a supposedly old world in 6 days. And so that God did create, as Genesis says, but then placed into creation fossils and carbon decay and the light distant galaxies and everything else to give the appearance of an old world and universe. This view doesn't sit entirely well with me because it gives the impression of a misleading creator, but I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on this.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. And, you know, I'm aware of the fact that this is often called young earth creationism, and it was one of the things we did talk about in our podcast, the idea that taking a very literalistic timing of the dates in Genesis, you can calculate that the creation happened a matter of thousands of years before Christ, and that and therefore all the scientific evidence of an old earth and the age of the universe and so on, all this is incredibly wrong, at orders of magnitude wrong. And we talked about this before, haven't we, that the problem with that position is that it basically says that the entire foundation of modern science is based on a hideous failures and mistakes, and that therefore the obvious implication of that is that all science that is based on this fundamental physics is completely unreliable. And yet, you know, that's the science which underpins absolutely everything that we're using all the time. It certainly underpins the internet that we're communicating with at the moment, the computers we're using. And it underpins the use of the mobile phones and GPS and everything else, which are all constantly testing the laws of physics. Which are based on quantum physics, on general relativity, and so on. So I think that it's very hard to accept that modern science is so completely and utterly mistaken and fooled. Is it possible that God is working in this way? Well, if you take the orthodox understanding, Christian understanding of science, which is one that I have completely accept and have reflected about and taught. And that is the idea that science is a way of following God's own thinking, of what the research scientist is doing as they investigate the structures of the world, of the cosmos, of the universe, is they are, in Kepler's famous phrase, they are thinking God's thoughts after them, that we are. In other words, it wasn't Einstein that invented the general laws of relativity, the way that science, that space curves around massive objects. It was God who wrote those laws, but Einstein's mind, astonishingly, was able to work them out. And there's a famous quote, I think it's from Einstein, that says that the most mysterious thing about the universe is its comprehensibility. In other words, why on earth can a pathetic little carbon-based life form and the pathetic little brain that evolved according to naturalistic evolution theories, you know, our brains, our central nervous systems evolved in order just to help us find berries on the African savannah and ways of getting away from saber-toothed tigers. And actually, I'm not sure there were saber-toothed tigers on the African savannah, but you know.
You take the point.
But why on earth should that pathetic little central nervous system be able to do things like write symphonies and do all the astonishing things that the human brain can do, but then in particular understand the fundamental laws by which the cosmos is developed? But of course, from a Christian point of view, if we are made in God's image, then there is it's understandable that there's some kind of homology between the human mind and the divine mind, the creator's mind. We're able to follow the divine reasoning, the divine logic, the divine physics. So to me, that makes total sense. And you know, working as a research scientist, I had a real thrill about the idea that I was trying to think God's thoughts about protecting babies' brains after him, that God had locked into the creation protective mechanisms and so on.
I guess to flesh out the question then, what about, because I agree the only way you can really credibly kind of believe in contemporary science and also want to hold to a literalistic understanding of Genesis is that God has built into the world the appearance and the you know, the constants and all the forces and everything that point towards a billions of year old Earth, but actually secretly made it in 6 days, you know. And so when he created the world, he made it with all the universe, all the various galaxies drifting apart from each other at a constant rate, which, you know, we can wind the clock back to a big bang, but actually they were actually created millions of light years apart, and you know, all that kind of stuff. Like, in theory, yes, I believe God could do that if he wanted to, but what has never made sense to me is why he would seek to deliberately and inexplicably mislead people and bake into his creation evidence, millions of pieces of evidence that point to the world working one way when he actually did it another way. You know, it's a neat way of resolving the issue if you are a young Christian evangelical scientist who wants to maintain what they were told at church and what they're learning in the lab. But actually, if you look at it from God's perspective, it's absolutely bizarre. If you've already decided you're going to make the universe in 6 days, why would you then bother to go to enormous lengths to obscure this fact from your image bearers and insert kind of mind-bogglingly complex levels of subterfuge into the very fabric of created order affecting every single atom and electron, just to fool people so that they, when they started to learn how to do science in a few thousand years, they would come to the wrong conclusion? It just makes, why would God be care if unless he was setting up some gigantic test of faith? It just doesn't really seem to make any sense to me.
Exactly. So that it does fundamentally question the character of God, because instead of, in the Orthodox understanding, God deliberately enabling human beings, supporting and encouraging human beings to understand the way the world is made, what is being proposed is that God deliberately designs the cosmos to be intensely deceptive, intentionally deceptive, and therefore fools not only all these atheistic, disbelieving scientist, but also manages to fool the vast majority of his followers and believers who are in all conscience trying to understand the universe. So he sets out to deceive vast numbers of his followers. And that seems to be so egregious way of understanding the character of God, and so flying in the face of everything that the Christian faith reveals about the character and nature and the faithfulness of God. One of the wonderful attributes of God is described in the Old Testament by the Hebrew word emet, which is usually translated faithfulness. Interestingly, I've only recently understood that it actually means much more. It means trustworthiness. It means that everything that God does and says is utterly truthful, utterly trustworthy, utterly to be relied on. And yet what's being proposed here is actually God is anything but trustworthy. God is using his power in order to deceive and mislead. And it just seems, it's impossible to me to worship a God like that.
Particularly a God who ultimately wants to be known and to be loved and to be in communion with us so much that he sends his own son at unbelievable cost to build a bridge to us. You know, this is a God who longs, who grieves the separation and the distance that exists between his people and himself. And why on earth would he seek to further that by engaging on this colossal deception and ultimately casting huge doubt on the truthfulness of Scripture, you know, in that I and you agree that there is no contradiction whatsoever between Genesis and science. But actually, a lot of Christians do wrestle with that subject, as we talked about in that evolution episode. And there's been a lot of, you know, angst has gone in trying to understand how those two books of science and faith and Scripture can be read together. And if God actually did make the world in 6 days, it would be great. The obvious thing would be to make that really obvious so that people could say, oh my gosh, this Genesis account is incredibly unerringly scientifically accurate. What a wonderful affirmation of the reality of God's existence. But
I think so. And it does just reflect a kind of, to me, almost a kind of desperation to try to cling to a particular interpretation of the Bible, which in itself is very hard to reconcile with all we know about the way the Scriptures were written, about the meanings of the original authors, and so on. So this young earth theory, I think most thinkers see as a product mainly of the Enlightenment or the pre-Enlightenment. It was the rise of the scientific method with people like Galileo and Newton and so on. And the obvious thing was, well, why don't we apply this same mechanistic scientific method to understanding Genesis? Mm. And actually, that was a pretty new idea. Certainly, previous Bible readers and commentators had not thought along those lines. So I think many people see New Earth creationism, Young Earth creationism, as the outworking of a scientific mechanistic way of thinking, which is then applied inappropriately to the Scriptures.
Yeah, and it's certainly, I think, a surprise to some people to discover that actually people often assume that, you know, Christians until Darwin all believed in a literalistic kind of mechanistic interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2, 6 days and 6,000 years old, etc. But actually, if you look at the patristics and the ancient church fathers, there was a huge diversity of beliefs about what happened. You know, and Augustine, for example, believed in an instantaneous creation. And there's been a long, as you say, long traditions of reading Genesis in poetic and various other ways. And actually, in many ways, it's a reaction against, during the Victorian era and the early 20th century, kind of the kind of creationism movement emerges as a reaction against this kind of hateful new science coming out of Victorian Britain, and particularly grows stronger in America after things like the Scopes monkey trials in the 1920s and that kind of thing. And actually, it's often presented as this is just a basic reading of Genesis. This is what Christians have always thought. But actually, historically, if you look at church history, it's quite a modern, innovative way of trying to understand science in Genesis.
I think that's right. I don't want to caricature sincere believers. And, you know, it's quite likely that some people listening to this podcast would still want to say, well, hang on a minute, what about and what if and all the rest. And I understand that. I think we want to encourage dialogue, understanding and so on. But in the end, it seems to me that the evidence very strongly stacks up. And the truthfulness and the trustworthiness of God points towards the trustworthiness of science.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about a brand new resource that we're offering this month from NT Wright. Ask NT Wright Anything, the Essential Collection. It's a compilation of Tom's most asked questions, like, should we pray to God the Father or Jesus? Should Christians improve the world if it's all being renewed anyway? Or how can I be a Christian and make sense of modern questions that defy God's existence? This resource is our thank you gift when you support Premier Insight this month. Your generosity equips believers across the country with biblical wisdom in a confused world. Go now to premierinsight.org/donate to request your copy. That's premierinsight.org/donate. Now, let's get back to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Shall we move on to a second question quickly? This is from Annabelle, she sent this in a few weeks ago, responding, I think, to our episode about dementia, where we talked a little bit about philosophy and autonomy and things like that. And she says this: your recent comment about philosophers caught me by surprise, as I have a wonderful Christian friend, theologian and philosopher. I'm also currently reading Nick Spence's new book, The History of Science and Religion, and the role of philosophers seems so central. Perhaps they might contribute more than just sitting and thinking.
I do recall the conversation about philosophers, and I certainly don't want to imply that philosophers haven't made great contributions in the area of thought generally, and including in the areas of theology and so on. But I do maintain my view that actually there are besetting sins and blind spots of philosophers. As we said before, in order to practice philosophy, certainly as a professional philosophy, you have to be a pretty weird kind of person. And you know, if you look at the history of philosophy and you look at, the outstanding thinkers and philosophers over the years, they are by no means, ordinary people with ordinary life experiences. And in particular, philosophers do tend to sit on their backsides and view that the main way to understand the world is by thinking about it. Whereas the rest of humankind engaged in active work and life, life wisdom tends to come not from sitting on your backside and reflecting. It comes from life experience. And I think that the blind spots of philosophers have led us down some dark and blind alleys. And I think one of the recent things that's happened is to start to hear the voices of other people, like, for instance, the voices of disabled people, the voices of people with different perspectives, the voices of women, the voices of people who don't come from a privileged, elite, male, Western background and so on. we've got a great deal to learn by listening to other voices, whilst respecting the fact that there have been remarkable contributions made by philosophers. I don't know, what do you think? I mean, you know, how do you rate philosophers in as people that you would turn to?
I think it's a really interesting question. I think I have a slightly different perspective on you. I think I'm slightly less critical of the discipline or those who practice it. I think we need to acknowledge that, you know, a lot of what we think about philosophy today is often, you know, the kind of, you know, contemporary academic philosophers who I think, you know, many of whom do interesting things and think interesting thoughts. But ultimately, actually, I think we need to look at the long span. You know, I did a really fascinating module in my history degree, which actually involved looking at a whole series of the kind of foundations of Western political thought, going back all the way to Aristotle, Plato in ancient Greece, and tracking that through to the 20th century through a kind of a hit list of the kind of 10, 15 or so kind of most prominent thinkers. And it was really interesting because actually you realize a lot of what underpins our culture, our society, our institutions, our constitution has fundamentally grown and evolved over years from thoughts that a philosopher sitting in a room somewhere reading books had and wrote down. And I think it's easy to look at contemporary philosophy, you know, and say, well, what is that person adding to society? This is just kind of ivory tower, navel gazing nonsense. You know, particularly, I think some of the late 20th century kind of where philosophy got quite absurd or nihilistic or kind of abstract. But actually, you can't, you know, Western liberal democracy rests on insights that philosophers like Locke and Hobbes, Machiavelli, you know, Rousseau, Thomas More, people who, you know, yes, they're all white privileged elite men, and I'll come on to that, but actually we wouldn't have the society we have today without some of the insights and some of the culture and institutions that were built on a bedrock of ideas. And I think fundamentally I'm a humanities person, I'm not a scientist, and I believe in the power of ideas, I believe in the power of the written word and of books and of the value of kind of sitting and thinking and writing. And so I'm a little reluctant to kind of junk the entire discipline and say what we need is, you know, more practitioners and doers. However, all of that said, I agree with a lot of your critique that philosophy has often been an incredibly kind of narrow profession, and that it is in desperate need, as frankly would be professional history or sociology or a lot of these humanities disciplines, is in desperate need of being grounded in a much more diverse range of people doing it, you know, more women, more ethnic minorities, more people from lower social classes, disabled people, whatever. You know, it is not healthy for an entire kind of intellectual firmament to be built up by people representing an incredibly kind of narrow cast of the societies they're thinking for. But I do believe there is value and merit in the idea of a discipline which says, let's think deeply about the world and try and draw conclusions and bat ideas around.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And, you know, and I'm fascinated by the history of philosophy and continue to read it. But, you know, there are certain things which strike me. One of the things which strike me is that ever since Plato, philosophers have been spending countless hours thinking about what it means to be human. I mean, about anthropology, you know, the nature of the human experience and so on. And, you know, they've focused on things like rationality and truth seeking and the image of God. You know, Christian philosophers have gone about that. And utterly astonishingly, in the history of philosophy, it appears that virtually nobody has ever really thought seriously about the reality that human beings are dependent organisms who come into this world utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of others, and who live almost every minute of their lives in dependence on other people as being a fundamental defining property of what it means to be human. And if you think about it, well, why didn't they ever think that? Well, answer, I'm not dependent. I sit on my sofa and food appears. You know, I'm cared for and looked after, and people do my washing and remove my excreta and provide me with water and it just happens. So I don't need to think about it. It's invisible. It's not part of being human. And it's only Alistair MacIntyre, world-class philosopher who writes a book called Dependent Rational Animals, where for the first time a philosopher actually writes a whole book about how dependence is a fundamental feature of being human. You know, he's a late 20th century philosopher after two millennia or more since Plato. And yet, you know, if you'd gone to any mother with a newborn baby and said, what strikes you about being human? You know, just tell us what you think about it means to be human. You know, any mother would say, you know, the thing that strikes me, how utterly and totally dependent it means to be a human baby. So, in other words, you know, why did that whole aspect of being human was completely ignored as being irrelevant by philosophers? And I think you could point to many other blind spots. That's not to decry the value of what they did achieve. It's just to point out that they were capable of extraordinary blind spots, which ordinary human beings living ordinary human lives would have told them in a blink of an eye.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of that. I guess my thought would be, in response to the question, the answer is not do we need less philosophers, but I would say the answer is we need more philosophers. We need to broaden the pool. We need to broaden the intellectual soil that they're working from. We don't want to say, you know, get out of your ivory tower and come and do a real job. We want to invite more people up the ivory tower so that the philosophy that is produced by the discipline and by the academics and by the people who devote their lives to this kind of weighty thinking is of greater value and is more grounded in the reality of human beings and life as it truly is. Right, let's call it quits there. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. As always, we'd love to hear more of your questions, more of your disagreements. It's really helpful for us to hear where we've got our own blind spots, which I'm sure are legion.
No, there is the thought.
So do get in touch with us. You can email molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. You can tweet me on Twitter, at T-S Wyatt. And do go to Dad's website, johnwyatt.com, for plenty more things to stimulate your own thinking. Even some engagement with philosophy, I'm led to believe, in a few of his articles. But thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, stain, tools, flooring, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online from May 8th through May 14th. Not a member? Join MyLowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.